This is the lecture for week 8, the second enclosure movement. We'll be talking today about copyright, trademark, and patents. And obviously, this is a huge territory, and so we can only give really the briefest introduction to some of the more salient themes in this topic. But the larger theme is the expansion of these bodies of law at the expense of the public domain and the ability of people to use knowledge, creative works, information in ways building upon other people's prior works. This is limited by the gross expansion of copyright, trademark, and patent law. Now, well, the main book that we read here is William Pattree's Moral Panics and the Copyright Wars, which came out in 2008, which is one of the best overviews of the current state of copyright law, not only from a matter of the laws and the court decisions, but in the almost the mythological narrative zone of how we conceive of copyright law. So it really gives a nice overview. But I would recommend a number of other really useful books, such as James Boyle's The Public Domain, James Boyle's Software, what's it called again? Shaman's Software and Spleens, a really pioneering book in 1995. Jessica Littman's Digital Copyright is an excellent overview of copyright law as the digital age was getting underway. And Peter Jassy, J-A-S-Z-I, at American University, is also an excellent author to consult in this area, particularly his book, The Construction of Authorship. Now, the themes that we're going to talk about today are why copyright is a battleground and what's at stake. And we're also going to illustrate how extreme and ridiculous the law has often become in these areas. We'll mention some examples from my book, Brand Name Bullies, which is a collection of stories about, as the subtitle puts it, the quest to own and control culture. And members of the class have also watched Carrie McLaren's video or DVD, The Illegal Art Exhibit, which is a collection of video snippets and audio clips of works that were most likely out and out illegal because they borrowed from existing works, particularly mass media films and TV shows and songs. And the idea was that all this creativity, much of it, which was very biting social commentary, was just out and out illegal under copyright and trademark law. And so one can quickly see that copyright and trademark law have some rather profound implications for our First Amendment rights, especially when the intellectual property laws are expanded as much as they have. Before I get too far along, let me also mention a number of very useful other DVDs. One that can be streamed online for free is called Good Copy, Bad Copy. And it's a terrific exploration of the copyright wars and how all sorts of new creativity is being stifled by copyright law. Another film that can be streamed for free is called Citizen 3.0, Copyright, Creativity, and Contemporary Culture. And actually, you can go to www.kinobserver.com to watch that. It's 10 separate segments about copyright featuring some of the most notable legal scholars today commenting on the state of copyright law. And I finally should mention Kembrew McLeod's DVD, Copyright Criminals, which again looks at the state of copyright from the perspective of new creators and how it's often a very inhibiting presence, copyright law. So let me start my remarks by talking about a real seminal essay that James Boyle wrote in about 2001 called the Second Enclosure Movement. Now, this was really at a very early stage in the popularization of free and open source software, and before the creation of what we now know today as Web 2.0 platforms, where on the web people could have interactive engagements with each other and thereby create all sorts of new collaborative commons online. So in some ways, Boyle's essay is a bit dated, but in other ways, it was very prescient in talking about some of the challenges that copyright law faces in the internet era. Now, a little bit of background on Boyle. He was the pioneering author of this book, Shame and Software and Spleens, which talks about the philosophical intellectual crack-up of intellectual property law as it was being applied to all sorts of new domains. The idea of originality and authorship, which are the justifications for property ownership in cultural works or knowledge, was just being taken to absurd extremes. The one example that he cites was the case of Moore v. Regents of California. And this was a case in 1990 that declared that a patient named John Moore had no property right interests in the cells derived from his own spleen. Now, what had happened is a doctor who was working for the University of California took some cells from Mr. Moore and developed what ended up to be a very lucrative cell line for research purposes, a $1 billion cell line, one might add. But eventually, when this reached the courts declared that Moore had no, that the cells were naturally occurring raw material that Moore had no property interest in. And so the doctor and the Regents of California, the University of California, were able to reap the property rights from someone else's cells. The whole discussion just brings into high relief some of the absurd logic and definitions that are used in copyright, trademarks, and patents, especially copyrights and patents, where this idea of original authorship or being an inventor is the justification for property rights. And the point is that often it's not the individual genius who created something, but the community of collaborators or the social context that was critical for new discoveries or for new creative innovations. Now, in talking about the Second Enclosure Movement, which was the subject of his essay in 2001, Boyle recalls the range of market enclosures of knowledge and culture that have been occurring. The scope and term of copyright law, for example, have been greatly expanded. Copyright at the time of the founders of the United States was a 14-year monopoly for authors. Then it gradually got expanded to 14 plus a renewal of 14 years. Well, starting in 1960, the terms of copyright law were expanded 11 times over the next 40 years, resulting in the law that now holds copyright lasts an author's lifetime plus 70 years, which is a ridiculous amount of time of monopolization over a work. It means that the scribbles on my shopping list or the notes for my speech are going to be locked up as private property until the year 2100 or so. And that's supposedly the amount of time I need to properly to have the incentive to create these things, because after all, the copyright is an incentive to authors to create things. Well, of course, that's absurd. It's not empirically necessary. Empirically, or there's no empirical evidence that this amount of monopoly protection is needed for authors to create their works. The scope of copyright has also expanded so that, for example, the first sale doctrine, which allows you to resell a book or a CD in digital form, has essentially been supplanted. under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act passed in 1998, nobody can reuse a work that is digitally encrypted unless they have permission or make a payment. So it essentially wipes out not only the first use first sale doctrine, but it also limits one's fair use rights for digital artifacts. Trademark protection has similarly been expanded through new sorts of doctrines that say you can't tarnish a trademark, which can be construed as if you make fun of a trademark product or company, you can be sued for tarnishing their trademark. It's a way of companies that own trademarks for controlling public meaning, essentially. Patents have been fantastically expanded over the past 20 or 30 years as well. Seth Shulman, in his book Owning the Future, talks about how there are now patents you can get for all sorts of business methods on the internet. For example, one-click shopping is a patent that Amazon got for its ability to click on your mouse to quickly shop. Well, this is really a rudimentary, basic way of behaving on the internet. Should somebody be able to own that? Similarly, all sorts of mathematical algorithms can now be owned when they're embedded in software, which really gets very close to owning facts and basic elements of knowledge. And also in patents, it's now possible to own genes. You can the gene that is suspected of causing breast cancer is now owned by the University of Pennsylvania and a number of other partners. This very patent has a chilling effect on researchers who may wish to do research on breast cancer but are fearful of running afoul of this patent on the gene. And there's even such things as patents on a crustless peanut butter and jelly sandwich. That one's owned by Smucker's, the jelly company. It's really all of this has the effect of shutting down the ability of future entrepreneurs and innovators from creating new products. And then James Boyle also discusses such things as protection for databases. The facts that are put in databases can be more effectively controlled through new laws to protect them. So this is what Boyle calls the second enclosure movement. In this case, not enclosing of land and its resources, but the enclosing of culture and information in all sorts of serious ways. Now, it used to be that intellectual property rights were the exception, and you almost had to go out of your way to get the protection of the law. You could assume that everything was available for use unless it was otherwise copyrighted, trademarked, or patented. But now it's essentially the opposite, in that all sorts of ordinary things are presumptively copyrighted, trademarked, or patented. They're locked up. One reason for this was that in 1976, when a major revision of copyright law was passed, they did away with these formalities that required you to affirmatively register in order to get copyright protection. Now, that sounds like a good idea to get rid of bureaucratic red tape, but in effect, what it meant was that everything is now born as private property. Scribble something on a piece of paper, play a few guitar notes, and record it on your tape recorder, it's copyrighted. And this had a very disastrous effect once digital technologies and the internet, especially, began to become quite popular, because it meant that the most minor amount of copying, like downloading something or visiting a website and copying what was on the server to your computer, is an illegal copy. And all sorts of ordinary behaviors on the internet or digital technologies became illegal because everything is born in an envelope of property rights. So Boyle talks about how the commons has been embraced as the opposite of property. It's a way to begin to describe a space that needs to be free from the incursions of intellectual property. And historically, this was known as the public domain. But historically, the public domain was regarded as essentially a dusty attic for government documents and our outdated sheet music from the 20s and other things that nobody really wanted, basically junk. The public domain was considered the equivalent of junk. And therefore, there was very little theoretical or scholarly interest in the public domain because all the action was in copyright law. Well, this started to change when the World Wide Web became popular in the mid-90s, and suddenly the ability to have an open space of content that wasn't owned and the ability to reuse content was a practical necessity. And as free software and Linux began to take off, we began to realize that the sharing of things, the online collaboration of things, were important. And so this dusty concept of the public domain began to have a new life, and it began to sort of morph into or be renamed the commons, which helped indicate its social or its creation or its life as a social practice, as opposed to an inert wasteland for old cultural product. It helps in talking about copyright to understand how it's been understood, the meta-narratives we use to understand it. Many copyright advocates like to consider copyright property in a traditional sense, and they often compare it to real property or to your car. The film industry, for example, frequently says, I won't steal your car, so why are you stealing my DVDs? As if the two were the same. And of course, there's a significant difference. If you take my car, I can't use it myself. But the content on a DVD or a CD can often be replicated for next to nothing once it's created in the first place. And therefore, you're not necessarily depriving anybody of anything. And furthermore, copyright is not like property in another sense. Copyright has time limits. Copyright has limitations on its use, limitations on the property rights, such as fair use or the first sale doctrine. Lots of carve-outs, in other words, in the property right. And so it's really fallacious to simply equate copyright to property in a facile, glib way, because there's all sorts of very important qualitative differences between the two. A better way to look at it is copyright as a public bargain. It's in return for giving authors an artificial monopoly on creative works, a text or images or music. The public gets the work itself and stipulated types of access. They'll get fair use to excerpt things for scholarship or journalism or education. And they will have first sale doctrine so that the object can be resold without impediment. There'll be limited terms so that the content will go into the public domain after a certain period. So this is the bargain between authors and the public as mediated by government. And you'll note that this is quite different from copyright as a natural right, something that could be said to exist before the state even comes into being. Copyright's a public bargain. It's a statutory creation enforced by the courts, not something that is mystically natural and universal. It's been called, quite frankly, a tax on readers for the purpose of giving a bounty to writers. And note that the point is, as they say in the U.S. Constitution, to promote the advancement and diffusion of knowledge. It's not to protect authors' rights. Authors have copyright solely as an instrument to promote the creation and diffusion of knowledge. So many of the familiar justifications for copyright are really just pure rhetoric and polemics. When people say, for example, that the author is the parent of a work and you wouldn't take a child from the parent, or that the author is like a farmer who has sowed seeds and therefore is entitled to what he has to reap what he has sown, those are just rhetorical arguments that have no standing in the law or the history of copyright. A famous quote comes from Lord Macaulay in the British House of Lords in 1841, in which he said, "It is good that authors should be remunerated, and the least exceptional way of remunerating them is by monopoly. Yet monopoly is an evil. For the sake of good, we must submit to the evil, but the evil ought not to last a day longer than is necessary for the purpose of securing the good." Now, I ask, what other forms of property do we make such claims that we shouldn't have the ownership rights exist for a day longer than necessary? So, as the Constitution puts it, the copyright is to promote the progress of science and the useful arts, not to give authors some universal perpetual right. Now, for most of the 20th century, copyright was stable and of little interest to the public. It was kind of in a backwater of public policy that few people paid attention to except the affected industries. And that's because any public controversies were really inter-industry debates that did not substantially affect the public's fair use rights or the public domain. So it was, for example, jukebox makers versus sheet music publishers about the limits of copyright control, or disputes between broadcast TV and the rights of cable TV to rebroadcast broadcast signals, things like that. And as a result of this, what grew up over time was this fantastically complicated mess of incomprehensible law that was based on political compromises and lobbying, not on any philosophical consistency or clarity. As Jessica Littman, a copyright professor at University of Michigan, puts it, "Each time we rely on current stakeholders to agree on a statutory scheme, they produce a scheme designed to protect themselves against the rest of us. Its rigidity leads to its breakdown. The statute's drafters have incorporated too few general principles to guide courts in effecting repairs." Essentially, by letting the affected industries negotiate a series of fact-specific solutions, each one reflecting that moment in politics and the history of technology, Congress, in effect, let copyright law become this messy agglomeration of complex, irregular political compromises. And it's just become an incoherent mess. Now, all of this might not have concerned us, the public, that is, and other creators, but for the fact that the internet began to make the public domain consequential. As I mentioned, as new technology, digital technologies and the internet became popular, suddenly the public had a role as a creator and reuser of content, and it wasn't just an inter-industry dispute anymore. Essentially, the social sharing and collaboration that emerged on the internet challenged the philosophical framework of copyright law in our theories of how creativity emerges and occurs. Copyright thinks that the individual genius with originality creates something new, and that justifies the copyright in the work. But as we've seen, as digital technologies have flourished, creativity takes place in a social context. There's lots of people that are involved in it, and we routinely borrow from works that have been made in the past. We take Leonard Bernstein took the themes of Romeo and Juliet and created West Side Story. Musicians are constantly taking melodic themes and styles from other times and reworking them. Fashion does the same thing, where you're constantly pillaging other creators in the past to create something new. Now, is it original? In many ways, yes, but in many ways, it's derivative. And so this has been a core growing problem within copyright law, as the basis of individual originality has waned as it's become more socially contextualized. It's not always clear who's the author. One can think of open source software and Wikipedia today as major artifacts where individual authorship is kind of a ridiculous concept, because so many people have been involved in so many interrelated, murky ways. Now, one reason I find a lot of clarity in William Patry's moral panics in the copyright wars is that he gets above the straight-up history of copyright law, which is important and valuable to read, but helps us understand why we are in such a morass, both politically, polemically, and intellectually, about copyright law. Now, Patry is the senior copyright counsel at Google, and he's a former copyright counsel to the House Judiciary Committee. And for many, many years, he wrote a popular copyright blog until he became so dispirited by the state of copyright trends that he basically shut down the blog. And this book reflects a tremendous amount of erudition, yet it's tremendously accessible and lucid as well. And Patry makes the claim that the current copyright wars are essentially about bad business models, failed economic ideologies, and the acceptance of inappropriate metaphors that have led to an unjustified expansion of copyright laws. As he puts it, quote, "The battle is being fought to preserve old business models, closed methods of distribution, and restricted consumer experiences. And publishers are determined and tightly controlled by the copyright industries rather than being responsive to consumer preference." He talks about this in many different contexts, but makes the point in each of them that industry is failing to meet the desires of consumers and to retool their business model. They are fighting innovation, essentially, and trying to protect their antiquated business models, which happen to have a large amount of fixed investment. In music, the industry has resisted the new technology and the new social practices and the new ways that people want to relate to cultural works. For example, they have fought the post in music, everybody used to create albums. Well, people don't want to buy albums anymore. They fought that. The internet has created something called the long tail, which is the viability of very small niche markets for minor content. Some half of the books that Amazon sells are ranked 100,000 or more in their sales rankings. Yet those are tremendously profitable taken together. So the music industry has also fought the growth of long tail markets. The music industry has fought the ubiquitous social use of music, preferring that to sell just little vinyl CDs and not have it be digitally floating around in people's iPods and other new technologies. And the industry has fought the new regime of having access to music rather than owning it. The industry wants to sell ownership of CDs and albums. They didn't want to sell access. And finally, the music industry has resisted the new generation of what's known as poll marketing, where users can poll content to themselves rather than the push marketing that has traditionally existed, where the content industries, be they TV or films or music, have pushed content at us through advertising. That too is an obsolete notion, but they're reluctant to give up that model. They don't know how to get out of it. They don't want to get out of it, essentially. A lot of this is detailed in a great book by Steve Knopper called Appetite for Self-Destruction, which details the industry's dogged insistence upon its control business model at the expense of the new ways that users wanted to interact with music and share it and copy it. So essentially, the open platforms and the digital commonses have posed these profound challenges to existing business models and indeed to the very premises of copyright law. But the industry, rather than trying to find some accommodation or to get ahead of these very real, very persistent trends, has instead fought a rearguard action to try to stave off innovation. And one of the ways that the industry has fought to stave off innovation, to stave off the new social relationships that the technologies are creating, is through language. You use language to create a justification for not changing. Patry points out how metaphors have been indispensable to creating a social construction of criminal behavior. The very metaphor of privacy is a way to preempt discussion about what is or what should be legal or illegal. And the new technologies that allow easy copying are considered presumptively criminal simply because they facilitate copying. Even though there are all sorts of viable business models that can work and are working under a system in which there is copying. So one way that the industry has used language and myth, as Patry points out, to buttress their antiquated notions of property rights is to assert certain myths, to make certain historical and cultural contingencies seem utterly natural and inevitable, if not universal. One of them is what Patry calls the utilitarian consequentialist origin story. And this is that if we give copyright protection to authors, then we're going to get more works. It will be the incentive to authors, and they will produce more output, and society will be better for it. Unfortunately, there's very little empirical evidence that if you give more copyright protection, that will produce greater output. In 1998, Congress gave an extension of 20 years to copyright protection, in part because Disney didn't want Mickey Mouse to enter the public domain in 2003. Yet, nobody can say that this 20-year extension incented the creation of more works, because Walt Disney was dead, Robert Frost was dead, all sorts of musicians and composers and other authors were dead, yet their copyrights were being extended by 20 years, the benefit going to their estates or to the companies that owned those copyrights. And in other words, copyright extensions and the expansions of scope are often merely grabs of property that have nothing to do with the empirical output that might occur as a result. So it's a nice myth, but it really doesn't have much reality. There's no evidence that greater IP protection will enhance creative output or improve the economy. It often has quite the opposite effect by preventing or inhibiting future creators from drawing upon those previous works because they're not available in the public domain. When there was an author, Alice, I'm blanking on her name, created a parody of Gone with the Wind called The Wind Done Gone. she drew upon that previous work, which would have entered the public domain but for the 1998 copyright term extension. Well, because of that, she ran afoul of the estate that owned Margaret Mitchell's copyrights, and had to negotiate for the right to publish her parody. It was locked up in litigation for a while. And it was a perfectly legitimate commentary on some of the racist themes of Gone with the Wind. Another myth that the copyright industries often use is the so-called labor origin story, where copyright is justified on the basis of, not on the basis of originality, but on the labor expended in creating something. But there's nothing in the statute or law that says just because you expend this energy, you're entitled to the property right. That's not a factor. Somebody once compiled a version of the telephone numbers in a famous case and were sued by the original creator of the telephone directory. But the fact of compiling that is not the entitlement for a property right under copyright. And then, of course, there's the claim that copyright is a natural right, something that pre-exists the state. And it's perhaps an appealing rhetorical claim, but the Supreme Court rejected this quite clearly in 1834, and so it hasn't had any legal standing for a good 150 years. I liked how Patry points out that, to my surprise, copyright has historically been unimportant to many, many authors. Before 1978, as I mentioned, authors needed to formally register in order to obtain the benefits of copyright law. And as a result, in fact, very few used their works. Based on copyright renewal rates in the late 1950s, only 7% of books were renewed, which means that the rest of the books enter the public domain quite quickly, or if they hadn't been registered, immediately. For periodicals, only 11% were renewed. Movies, at the other extreme, because so much money was required to make them, 74% of them had their copyrights renewed. That said, 26% of them entered the public domain. So once the formalities, when formalities are required, if you didn't renew or didn't register them, then everything could be more, other things that weren't registered could be made more available to the public. The public domain would be more robust. Instead, we've had a gross overprotection of cultural works. Another chapter that Patry writes, which I found very illuminating, was about property as social relationships. It's common for various content industries to regard copyright as property and property as an object that exists without any obligation or relationship to the public. It's simply an individual entitlement. But of course, even describing copyright as intellectual property, which has no bearing otherwise in the law, is essentially a political strategy to, as Patry says, achieve a result that denies the existence of obligations to others and that seeks to avoid all government regulation. So invoking the word property is a way to try to sever the connection of property as a social relationship, which historically it always has been. Property doesn't exist in a social or political or creative vacuum. It exists in a culture. And we have to be aware of that because as a monopoly, copyright gives copyright owners an easy government-created ability to be anti-competitive and to thwart innovation in ways that could be harmful to the public interest. So property rights have consequences for the economy and for our social lives and our civic lives. Patry cites a great quote from a professor, Joseph Singer, who writes that property is never an extra legal institution free of social choices. Property is quintessentially and absolutely a social institution. Every conception of property reflects those choices that we as a society have made. Essentially, property represents a decision to use the power of the state to allocate a certain object or designated legal artifact to the owner and to prevent others from using that thing without the owner's consent. So this is a considerable power. To giving a property right isn't just something libertarian and individual. It means that the government and the courts and the penalties of all of them will step in to defend those property rights. And those property rights being an artificial monopoly besides. So it's important for us to remember that property is necessarily relational, and it's a creation of society, especially the legislatures, for the benefit of society. And it's not a freestanding, natural, individual, universal norm. We got this idea, unfortunately, from the 1760s when the jurist William Blackstone created his famous definition of property as, quote, the sole and despotic dominion which one man claims and exercises of the external things of the world, a total exclusion of the right of any other individual in the universe. And what's odd about this formulation is that even though it's much quoted, it's never really existed in fact, because property has never been a matter of absolute dominion. It's always been limited in many important ways for social or political purposes. Yet property theorists, or as they're often called, property maximalists, generally like to avoid the issue of how property was acquired in the first place, because that begins to raise some uncomfortable questions about those justifications of property. You know, how was the property acquired in the first place? Was it simply because he was the first one there, or that he expended some labor to get it? Well, those are not necessarily the most compelling reasons, generally speaking. But property rights advocates don't really want to go down too far down that road, because it might open the door to a larger discussion about property as social relations. And once we start to regard property as an order with an order of society that has implications for how we're going to treat each other, well, that begins to open up the door to questions like, what kind of social relationship should we have? Who should benefit most? The big companies, the big studios, the big record labels, or the public? Should copyright trump the First Amendment and our free speech rights, for example? It's far easier to simply say copyright is property and try to preempt those kinds of questions and discussions. Now, I tried to open the door to some of those questions in writing my book, Brand Name Bullies, The Quest to Own and Control Culture. And what I did was gather up a wide array of stories that showed how ludicrous and absurd copyright and trademark law had become. And it was a story-driven account that anybody could understand and go, what? So, for example, there's a famous artwork by Heidi Cody called American Alphabet from 2000, which consists of, it's an installation piece of a light box with 26 letters, each letter of the alphabet. And each letter is a corporate logo, each of which, of course, is trademarked as part of the product name. And what's uncanny is how every letter of the alphabet is readily discernible as the letter of a familiar product. There's O for Oreos and C for Campbell's soup and M for M&M's and, I'm looking at the list here, other R for Reese's peanut butter cups. You can probably pick out at least half of them. And it's a nice illustration of how far ownership rights have gone and how there has been either a symbolic and sometimes literal appropriation of such basic elements of culture. Another famous example of this is Barbie dolls. Mattel is one of the most notorious brand name bullies in its enforcement of its perceived trademark rights in the doll. Now, about 10 years ago, there was this photographer in Utah who did a small exhibit of photographs of Barbie in various kitchen appliances and various sexual positions. And essentially, he was trying to make fun of Barbie and the cultural image that she portrays by his photos. Well, even though it was a very small exhibit that only cost about $5,000 to mount, Mattel came down like gangbusters on him, claiming that he was violating, Tom Forsythe is the photographer, was violating Mattel's trademarks in Barbie dolls. And the case took several years and about $2 million in legal expenses. Forsythe obtained a pro bono law firm to work for him to defend his First Amendment rights. But Forsythe eventually prevailed against Mattel in what was a rather precedent-setting decision in which the photographer's rights to exhibit the Barbie doll photographs was upheld. And this was really the first time that Mattel had been called to account, because it had prevailed simply through its bullying in so many instances. For example, forcing the publisher of a book about anorexic disorders, which used the word Barbie in the title, to change the book title. Things like that. And the supreme irony is that Barbie dolls were copied from a German novelty doll of the 1950s, which was kind of a off-color sexual doll itself. So, you know, who is Mattel to be claiming that its trademark had been violated when it itself had essentially ripped off the idea from something pre-existing? Now, the ownership of letters that I mentioned earlier is actually not an aberration. There's letters and words that are fully owned. McDonald's has had numerous lawsuits against restaurants and others that have used the letters Mick, M-C, in their name. So you can't call your restaurant Mick Sushi or Mick Vegan or Mick Dharma. All of those have been considered a violation of McDonald's trademark. And so you have the spectacle of a San Diego-based company claiming a Scottish-Irish prefix as their private property. Similarly, the U.S. Olympics Committee owns a statutory right to the word Olympics. As a result, they've been able to prevent the Gay Olympics from using that term. It's a violation of their trademark. Yet, of course, they've allowed the Special Olympics to use the term Olympic. But the idea of a word being owned like that, especially one with such a long heritage in human history, is just absurd. There's even a Japanese company that owns the phoneme Zilla, as in Godzilla. It has gone after all sorts of innocuous things, like a website that called itself Davezilla and claimed that it was violating its trademark. The copyright scholar Kembru McLeod made fun of a lot of these things when he, as a grad student, applied for a trademark in the phrase freedom of expression and got it from the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. And he has a copy of the certificate that he shows. And first of all, it's kind of absurd that you can get a trademark on that phrase, freedom of expression. But then the real punchline came when AT&T developed a telephone calling plan that it called freedom of expression. And McLeod proceeded to send a cease and desist letter to AT&T to tell them that he owned the phrase. But of course, knowing that he was just an individual and a prankster at that, AT&T ignored him and, of course, paid no price for ripping off the phrase that he had trademarked. It just, McLeod's point was made, but the point is the little guy loses and the brand name bully can prevail. Now, there are literally dozens of these stories, some of them maybe perhaps trivial, others illustrating, I think, profound points about the limitations of culture in our society. Things like not being able to take photographs in Starbucks because you're ripping off the trade dress interior, which might be copied by someone. This was a case was happening many years ago when people were being told by store managers you couldn't take a photo in a Starbucks. You had the case of Matt Groening, who built his career on making fun of other cultural figures and images. Matt Groening, who created The Simpsons. Well, he also created a cartoon character called Binky the Rabbit. And when a zine publisher published a zine, a small self-made press, which on its cover had Binky the Rabbit punching out the Trix Rabbit, which was kind of a funny image, Groening's attorneys sued and forced the destruction of all copies of the zine, which was called Bunny Hop. Another example of the brand name bullying. So this is an example of some of the frontline realities of what happens when copyright and trademark is just pushed to such extremes. The illegal art exhibit was an attempt to dramatize this in the early 2000s with a collection of images and audio sounds, music, and video images, all of which drew upon trademarked copyright culture to make cultural points. I think many of these can still be found online at the illegal art website if you want to look at it. Sort of an early example of copyright protest, which by 8-10 years later now seems almost quaint because it happens so easily and frequently, especially with the rise of sites like YouTube. And in fact, copyright and trademark owners are getting used to the social circulation, the unauthorized social circulation of their works, because they realize that's how value is created. If nobody circulated their works, nobody would know it, nobody would consider it worthwhile or valuable. So we're starting to get this interesting inversion of traditional notions of property right as exclusion to value being created through sharing. A really fascinating trend that we will examine in a future lecture. In fact, the next two lectures will be kind of follow-throughs of today's lecture. The next one will be in week 9, will be the Internet as a supercommons, which will explain why the Internet functions as kind of a hosting infrastructure for all sorts of commons and is itself a commons because of the shared protocols for sharing information. And that will be followed in week 10 by a lecture on the new genres of collaborative creativity and the economics of online sharing, essentially how the commons is facilitating these new cultural forms and new business models that are quite compatible with sharing. So that ends this lecture, this brief flyby of some of the key issues in copyright, trademark, and patent.